Dear listener, dear friend, the music you have just heard is the rondo from the second orchestral suite by Johann Sebastian Bach. It is one of my favorite pieces of music. It makes me feel very sad, probably because I associate it with loss. I used to play it over and over again at a time when I was suffering terribly from a broken love affair. The melancholy beauty of the music helped me to cry, and so ease the constricting pain in my throat. There is a poem written by Thomas Hardy that does almost the same thing to me. Hardy wrote it to express how he felt when he found out that his estranged wife had unexpectedly died. It is called The Going. Why did you give no hint that night, that quickly, as if indifferent quite, you would close your term here, up and be gone, where I could not follow with wing of swallow to gain one glimpse of you ever anon, never to bid goodbye, or lip me the softest call, or utter a wish for a word, while I saw morning harden upon the wall, unmoved, unknowing that your great going had placed that moment and altered all. Why do you make me leave the house and think for a breath it is you I see at the end of the alley of bending boughs where so often at dusk you used to be? Till in darkening dankness, the yawning blankness of the perspective sickens me. You were she who abode by those red-veined rocks far west. You were the swan-necked one who rode along the beetling beany crest, and reining nigh me would muse and eye me, while life unrolled us its very best. Why then latterly did we not speak? Did we not think of those days long dead? And ere your vanishing, strive to seek that time's renewal. We might have said, in this bright spring weather, we'll visit together those places that once we visited. Well, well, all's past amend, unchangeable. It must go. I seem but a dead man, held on end, to sink down soon. Oh, you could not know that such swift fleeing, no soul foreseeing, not even I, would undo me so. The sense of loss, of helplessness in the face of death, of regret for things undone and words unspoken, of yearning for what can never again be, is overpowering in Hardy's poem. Gerard Manley Hopkins saw intimations of such feelings in a very young child's response to the turning of the leaves in fall. He called his poem Spring and Fall to a Young Child. Margaret, are you grieving over Golden Grove unleaving? Leaves like the things of man, you with your fresh thoughts care for, can you? Ah, as the heart grows older, it will come to such sights colder by and by, nor spare a sigh, though worlds of wanwood leave me a lie. And yet you will weep, and know why. Now, no matter, child, the name, sorrow springs are the same. Nor mouth had, no, nor mind expressed, what heart heard of, ghost guessed. It is the blight man was born for. It is Margaret you mourn for. Had anyone asked, Margaret could not have told why she was sad when she saw worlds of wanwood leaf me lie. But something inside her, some human intuition or foreknowledge common to all of us, even when we are very young, made her sense man's mortality, her own mortality, which is indeed the source of all grief. Sorrow springs are the same. Hopkins suggests that as we grow older, we become inured to the coming on of death. Well, some do, and some don't, I think. Dylan Thomas never did, never could accept death. He even tried magic against it, writing an incantation called "And Death Shall Have No Dominion." When his father lay dying, Thomas wrote an anguished and furious protest against the always inopportune moment of death. It is called, "Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night." Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Though wise men at their end know dark is right, because their words had forked no lightning, they do not go gentle into that good night. Good men, the last wave by, crying how bright their frail deeds might have danced in a green bay, rage, rage against the dying of the light. Wild men, who caught and sang the sun in flight, and learned too late they grieved it on its way, do not go gentle into that good night. Grave men, near death, who see with blinding sight blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay, rage, rage against the dying of the light. And you, my father, there on the sad height, curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. The last stanza of this poem kills me. Curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Anything but eternal silence. I watched my own father slip away into the mass anonymity of death. How I wished I had the talent to make him immortal in poetry, to stamp forever upon the page the sound of his wit and the image of his splendid beauty. In one of his sonnets, Shakespeare declared that he would make his love immortal with that very poem. And indeed he did. Who would remember the Earl of Southampton if it weren't for Shakespeare's 154 sonnets? Here's one of them. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often is his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometime declines, by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest, nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe, or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee. Another Shakespearean sonnet states the same theme, but more tentatively. Here the poet wonders whether his craft can circumvent the terrible ravages of the arch-villain time. Since brass, nor stone, nor earth, nor boundless sea, but sad mortality o'ersways their power, how with this rage shall beauty hold a plea? whose action is no stronger than a flower. Oh, how shall summer's honey breath hold out against the wrackful siege of battering days, when rocks impregnable are not so stout, nor gates of steel so strong, but time decays. Oh, fearful meditation! Where, alack, shall time's best jewel from time's chest lie hid? Or what strong hand can hold his swift foot back? Or who his spoil of beauty can forbid? Oh, none, unless this miracle have might, that in black ink my love may still shine bright. Another one of my favorite passages in music occurs in the fourth movement of Brahms's Piano Concerto No. 2. The melody played by Richter on the piano is made up of such crystal pure notes that it seems to me to represent icy clear water running and tumbling over the stones in a country stream. I know a poem that recreates the sound of water, but a darker water in a darker mood. The name of it is Inversnaid, and it was written by Gerard Manley Hopkins again. I'll read it to you when the music is ended. Now Inversnaid, which is a waterfall in the Hebrides. This darksome burn, horseback brown, his roll rock high road roaring down, in coop and in comb the fleece of his foam flutes and low to the lake falls home. A wind puff bonnet of fawn froth turns and twindles over the broth of a pool so pitch black, fell frowning, it rounds and rounds despair to drowning. Degged with dew, dappled with dew, are the groins of the braes that the brook treads through. Wiry heath packs, flitches of fern, and the bead bunny ash that sits over the burn. What would the world be once bereft of wet and of wildness? Let them be left, Oh, let them be left, wildness and wet. Long live the weeds and the wilderness yet. I must say I love the poems of Hopkins. I love their sound, their made-up words, their highly wrought texture. But I especially love their passionate grappling with God. I love them for the same reasons I love the holy sonnets of John Donne. Let me read you first Batter My Heart, written by Donne in the 17th century, and then Thou Art Indeed Just, Lord, written by Hopkins in the 19th century, and you will see how similar they are. Batter my heart, three-personed God. For you as yet but knock, breathe, shine, and seek to mend, that I may rise and stand, or throw me, and bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new. I, like an usurped town to another due, labor to admit you. But oh, to no end. Reason, your viceroy in me, me should defend, but is captived and proves weak or untrue. Yet dearly I love you, and would be loved fain, but am betrothed unto your enemy. Divorce me, untie or break that knot again. Take me to you. Imprison me, for I, except you enthrall me, never shall be free, nor ever chaste, except you ravish me. And now thou art indeed just, Lord. Thou art indeed just, Lord, if I contend with thee. But, sir, so what I plead is just. Why do sinners' ways prosper? And why must disappointment all I endeavor end? Wert thou my enemy, O thou my friend, how wouldst thou worse, I wonder, than thou dost defeat thwart me? O, the sots and thralls of lust do in spare hours more thrive than I that spend, sir, life upon thy cause. See banks and brakes now, leave it how thick. Laced they are again with fretty chervil, look, and fresh wind shakes them. Birds build, but not I build. No, but strain, time's eunuch, and not breed one work that wakes. Mine, O thou Lord of life, send my roots rain. It is obvious to me that both John Donne and Gerard Manley Hopkins had stormy love affairs with God. What they feared most was the aridity of the soul that comes from lack of faith. They wanted to believe, to love completely, unquestioningly, unreflectingly, as Keats would say. But I'm afraid that they wanted signs of being loved in return. And that last thing is what we must not ask of God, nor perhaps of a human lover either. It is grace enough to be able to love. To be loved in return is beatitude. At the end of his sonnet, Hopkins pleads with God, "Send my roots rain." There is a marvelous poem by George Herbert which seems to be a direct answer to Hopkins, except that Herbert lived 2 centuries before Hopkins. Herbert, too, had prayed for the life-giving, the soul-nurturing rain, and God had heard the poet's cry when he'd all but given up. The Flower is a devout and lovely poem of thanks for God's unexpected ways. How fresh, O Lord, how sweet and clean are thy returns, even as the flowers in spring, to which, besides their own demean, the late past frosts tributes of pleasure bring. Grief melts away like snow in May, as if there were no such cold thing. Who would have thought my shriveled heart could have recovered greenness? It was gone quite underground, as flowers depart to see their mother root when they have blown. Where they together, all the hard weather, dead to the world, keep house unknown. These are thy wonders, Lord of Power, killing and quickening, bringing down to hell and up to heaven in an hour, making a chiming of a passing bell. We say amiss this or that is. Thy word is all, if we could spell. Oh, that I once past changing were, fast in thy paradise, where no flower can wither. Many a spring I shoot up fair, offering at heaven, growing and groaning thither. Nor doth my flower want a spring shower, my sins and I joining together. But while I grow in a straight line, still upwards bent, as if heaven were mine own, thy anger comes, and I decline. What frost to that? What pole is not the zone where all things burn when thou dost turn and the least frown of thine is shown? And now in age I bud again. After so many deaths I live and write. I once more smell the dew and rain and relish versing. O my only light, it cannot be that I am he on whom thy tempests fell all night. These are thy wonders, Lord of Love, to make us see we are but flowers that glide, which when we once can find and prove, thou hast a garden for us where to bide. Who would be more, swelling through store, forfeit their paradise by their pride? The music which I think most agonizingly expresses this longing for faith, this contending with God, and the ultimate breakthrough to grace, is the third movement of the 15th quartet by Beethoven. It is sometimes referred to as the Heiliggedankengesang. I came to this music one night when I had just finished rereading Aldous Huxley's Point Counterpoint. In the novel, Spandrel has invited Rampion to his house to demonstrate to him positive proof of the existence of God. His proof is the music you are about to hear, and that I had to hear that very moment. At first I was shocked by the dissonances, the harsh grating sounds, but upon listening to the quartet again, I received the music into my heart. I could feel the terrible wrestling, the struggle to understand and to believe. When the resolution finally came, I felt that I had had a mystical experience. Tears of joy were running down my face. I was so happy.
Thank you. Thank you.
Laughing like crazy, I flung the chalky dust of your bones into the winds of Vermont. It was your April birthday. Now the corn grows high. The trees that border the field tremble and sigh. The amplitude of autumn stretches the land. You are in all I see. Oh, thank you for offering me this near-perfect day. The poem you have just heard is one I wrote when I had finally become reconciled to my husband's sudden death at the age of 46. With my own right hand, I had strewn his ashes like seeds over a certain field in Vermont. I called the poem Thermodynamics 2. A much, much better poem, with which I shall conclude this side of the cassette, is the little four-line poem by William Blake called Eternity. He who bends to himself for joy does the winged life destroy. But he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. spring is like a perhaps hand, which comes carefully out of nowhere, arranging a window into which people look while people stare, arranging and changing, placing carefully there a strange thing and a known thing here, and changing everything carefully. Spring is like a perhaps hand in a window, carefully to and fro moving new and old things, while people stare, carefully moving a perhaps fraction of flower here, placing an inch of air there, and without breaking anything. The spirited music that you have just heard is the opening section, La Primavera, from The Seasons by Vivaldi. I can never listen to this music without seeing in my mind's eye the great canvas by Matisse called The Dance, the one which hangs in the Hermitage in Leningrad. I want to get up and join hands with other dancers in a circle and stomp around with such abandon that the ground reverberates. The music is a celebration of spring. By comparison, the poem by E. E. Cummings, which is also a celebration of spring, seems delicate and quiet. The hand of the great window dresser is tentative, trying this effect and that, placing carefully a perhaps fraction of flower here and an inch of air there, until suddenly it is spring. There is another poem about spring by E. E. Cummings, which in its joyous rhythms and swinging upbeat would perhaps fit the Vivaldi music more accurately. I am thinking of the wonderfully optimistic poem, If Up's the Word and the World Grows Greener. If up's the word and the world grows greener, minute by second and most by more, if death is the loser and life is the winner, and beggars are rich but misers are poor, let's touch the sky with a to and a fro and a here, there, where, and away we go. In even the laziest creatures among us, a wisdom no knowledge can kill is astir. Now dull eyes are keen, and now keen eyes are keener, for young is the year, for young is the year. Let's touch the sky with a great and a gay and a steep, deep rush through amazing day. Its brains without hearts have set saint against sinner, put gain over gladness and joy under care. Let's do as an earth which can never do wrong does, minute by second and most by more. Let's touch the sky with a strange and a true and a climbing fall into far near blue. If beggars are rich and a robin will sing his robin a song, but misers are poor, let's love until no one could quite be, and young is the year, dear, as living as I'm and as you're. Let's touch the sky with a you and a me and an every who's any who's someone who's we. The high spirits and mindless exuberance of Cummings lead me on to a delightfully daffy poem from A Coney Island of the Mind by Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Don't let that horse eat that violin, cried Chagall's mother. But he kept right on painting and became famous.
and kept on painting, the horse with violin in mouth. And when he finally finished it, he jumped up upon the horse and rode away, waving the violin, and then with a low bow, gave it to the first naked nude he ran across. And there were no strings attached.
No, no, I can't go on with this. I had hoped to create on this cassette two moods, a kind of L'Allegro and Il Penseroso. But where are the joyous poems that are also the great poems? Why is it that poets, or novelists for that matter, so seldom write out of delight and ecstasy? Why is it that all the joy is tinged with melancholy? For every good poem which sings of spring and love and beauty, there exist 100 which remind us that springtime is short-lived, that youth grows pale and spectre thin and dies, that beauty cannot keep her lustrous eyes or new love pine at them beyond tomorrow. And even when the poet seems to be reveling in the lamb-white days of the child in the Garden of Eden, he is also mourning the inexorable expulsion from paradise. For as Dylan Thomas says, time held me green and dying, though I sang in my chains like the sea. Here is Thomas's wonderful bittersweet poem about his childhood, Fern Hill. Now as I was young and easy under the apple boughs, about the lilting house, and happy as the grass was green, the night above the dingle starry, time let me hail and climb golden in the heydays of his eyes. And honored among wagons, I was prince of the apple towns, and once below a time I lordly had the trees and leaves trail with daisies and barley down the rivers of the windfall light. And as I was green and carefree, famous among the barns about the happy yard, and singing as the farm was home in the sun that is young once only, time let me play and be golden in the mercy of his means. And green and golden, I was huntsman and herdsman. The calves sang to my horn. The foxes on the hills barked clear and cold. And the Sabbath rang slowly in the pebbles of the holy streams. All the sun long it was running. It was lovely. The hay fields high as the house. The tunes from the chimneys. It was air and playing. Lovely and watery and fire green as grass. And nightly under the simple stars as I rode to sleep, the owls were bearing the farm away. All the moon long I heard, blessed among stables, the nightjars flying with the ricks and the horses splashing into the dark. And then to awake and the farm like a wanderer white with the dew come back, the cock on his shoulder. It was all shining. It was Adam and maiden. The sky gathered again, and the sun grew round that very day. So it must have been after the birth of the simple light, in the first spinning place, the spellbound horses walking warm out of the whinnying green stable on to the fields of praise. And honored among foxes and pheasants by the gay house, under the new-made clouds, and happy as the heart was long in the sun-born over and over, I ran my heedless ways. My wishes raced through the house-high hay, and nothing I cared at my sky-blue trades, that time allows in all his tuneful turning so few and such morning songs, before the children green and golden follow him out of grace. Nothing I cared in the lamb-white days. The time would take me up to the swallow-thronged loft by the shadow of my hand, in the moon that is always rising. Nor that riding to sleep I should hear him fly with the high fields and wake to the farm forever fled from the childless land. Oh, as I was young and easy
in the mercy of his means.
Time held me green and dying, though I sang in my chains like the sea. The poet who is perhaps best known for lamenting the brevity of our lives, the transitoriness of youth, the frustration of our dreams, is A.E. Housman. Sometimes with irony, almost always with simplicity, he tells us life is short, life is sad, live while you may. His themes may be expressed in three familiar Latin phrases, ubi sunt, lacrimae rerum, and carpe diem. With rue my heart is laden, for golden friends I had, for many a rose-lipped maiden, and many a light-foot lad. By brooks too broad for leaping, the light-foot boys are laid, the rose-lipped girls are sleeping, in fields where roses fade. In Housman's poem, On Wenlock Edge, The Woods in Trouble, we get the sense of other generations, other civilizations having come and gone, having experienced the same emotions, seen the same sights. The wind blows now as it did in ancient times on Wenlock Edge. The land, the wind endure, but men and their works die. On Wenlock Edge, the woods in trouble. His forest fleece, the Wrekin, heaves. The gale, it plies the saplings double, and thick on Severn snow the leaves. 'Twould blow like this through holt and hanger, when Uricon the city stood. 'Tis the old wind in the old anger, but then it threshed another wood. Then, 'twas before my time, the Roman at yonder heaving hill would stare. The blood that warms an English yeoman, the thoughts that hurt him, they were there. There, like the wind through woods in riot, through him the gale of life blew high. The tree of man was never quiet. Then 'twas the Roman, now 'tis I. The gale, it plies the saplings double. It blows so hard, 'twill soon be gone. Today, the Roman and his trouble are ashes under Uricon. In the poem Bredon Hill, Housman tells the sad and ironic story of two young lovers who finally heed the church bells, but not as they had intended. In summertime on Bredon, the bells, they sound so clear. Round both the shires they ring them, in steeples far and near. A happy noise to hear. Here of a Sunday morning my love and I would lie, and see the colored counties, and hear the larks so high about us in the sky. The bells would ring to call her in valleys miles away. Come all to church, good people, come and pray. But here my love would stay, and I would turn and answer among the springing time, oh, peal upon our wedding, and we will hear the chime, and come to church in time. But when the snows at Christmas on Bredon top were strown, my love rose up so early, and stole out unbeknown, and went to church alone. They tolled the one bell only, groom there was none to see. The mourners followed after, and so to church went she, and would not wait for me. The bells they sound on Bredon, and still the steeples hum. Come all to church, good people. Oh, noisy bells, be dumb. I hear you. I will come. How beautiful is the dying cadence of the fifth line, which Housman has added to each traditional quatrain of the ballad form. I should like to play for you now music composed by Berlioz for two better-known tragic young lovers, Romeo and Juliet. This is the love motif with all its yearning, singing, melodic line.
Thank you.
The music sings the fullness of love, but again and again the warning note is sounded. Must great love always go hand in hand with great trouble? Are love and death the ultimate and welded antipodes? The poem I'm going to read next describes not love, but rape. It is the most erotic rape poem I know. It tells how the beautiful Leda was raped by Zeus, who had assumed the form of a swan. Out of their union came Helen, and thus eventually the Trojan War and its tragic aftermath. Here is Leda and the Swan by William Butler Yeats. A sudden blow, the great wings beating still above the staggering girl, her thighs caressed by the dark webs, her nape caught in his bill, he holds her helpless breast upon his breast. How can those terrified, vague fingers push the feathered glory from her loosening thighs? And how can body laid in that white rush but feel the strange heart beating where it lies? A shudder in the loins engenders there the broken wall, the burning roof and tower, and Agamemnon dead. Being so caught up, so mastered by the brute blood of the air, did she put on his knowledge with his power before the indifferent beak could let her drop? I should like to read to you two more poems by Yeats. First, The Wild Swans at Cooley, which for sheer beauty cannot be matched. The trees are in their autumn beauty. The woodland paths are dry. Under the October twilight, the water mirrors a still sky. Upon the brimming water, among the stones, are 59 swans. The 19th autumn has come upon me since I first made my count. I saw, before I had well finished, all suddenly mount and scatter wheeling in great broken rings upon their clamorous wings. I have looked upon those brilliant creatures, and now my heart is sore. All's changed since I, hearing at twilight, the first time on this shore, the bell beat of their wings above my head, trod with a lighter tread. Unwearied still, lover by lover, they paddle in the cold, companionable streams, or climb the air. Their hearts have not grown old. Passion or conquest, wander where they will, attend upon them still. But now they drift upon the still water, mysterious, beautiful. Among what rushes will they build? By what lake's edge or pool delight men's eyes when I awake some day to find they have flown away? I find irresistible in this poem the still beauty of the autumnal scene and the melancholy tone of the speaker. Yeats has begun his brilliant series of poems about growing old, which will culminate in Sailing to Byzantium. In that poem, he shows how the loss of physical powers can be compensated only by their transmutation into spiritual energy and aesthetic creativity. Matter becomes fire. The mortal poet becomes the immortal poem. Here is Sailing to Byzantium. That is no country for old men. The young in one another's arms, birds in the trees, those dying generations at their song, the salmon falls, the mackerel crowded seas, fish, flesh, or fowl, commend all summer long whatever is begotten, born, and dies. Caught in that sensual music, all neglect monuments of unaging intellect. An aged man is but a paltry thing, a tattered coat upon a stick, unless soul clap its hands and sing, and louder sing for every tatter in its mortal dress. Nor is there singing school, but studying monuments of its own magnificence. And therefore I have sailed the seas and come to the holy city of Byzantium. O sages standing in God's holy fire, as in the gold mosaic of a wall, come from the holy fire, turn in a gyre, and be the singing masters of my soul. Consume my heart away, sick with desire, and fastened to a dying animal, it knows not what it is, and gather me into the artifice of eternity. Once out of nature, I shall never take my bodily form from any natural thing, but such a form as Grecian goldsmiths make of hammered gold and gold enameling to keep a drowsy emperor awake, or set upon a golden bough to sing to lords and ladies of Byzantium of what has passed or passing or to come. Once more the villain is time, time the symbol of our organic growth and decay. Yeats longs to escape from our bondage to time. He wants to be gathered into the artifice of eternity, to become a thing, a work of art, not subject to time's tyranny. How ironic that he would choose to be a golden bird set upon a golden bough to sing of what is past or passing or to come, to be, in other words, an immortal poet. But isn't there irony, too, in Yeats's choice of the word artifice, when he might have said artifact? Do we not deceive and beguile ourselves with the very myth of eternity? There is no such thing. Nothing, not bodies nor souls, not works of art nor civilizations, can escape from the steadily advancing shadow cast by the westering sun. Archibald MacLeish expresses this despair in his poem, You, Andrew Marvell. And here, face down beneath the sun, and here upon earth's noonward height, to feel the always coming on, the always rising of the night, to feel creep up the curving east, the earthy chill of dusk, and slow upon those underlands the vast and ever-climbing shadow grow. And strange at Ecbatan the trees take leaf by leaf the evening, strange the flooding dark about their knees, the mountains over Persia change. And now at Kermanshah the gate, dark, empty, and the withered grass, and through the twilight now the late few travelers in the westward pass. And Baghdad darken, and the bridge across the silent river gone, and through Arabia the edge of evening widen and steal on, and deepen on Palmyra Street the wheel rut in the ruined stone, and Lebanon fade out, and Crete high through the clouds and overblown, and over Sicily the air still flashing with the landward gulls, and loom and slowly disappear the sails above the shadowy hulls, and Spain go under, and the shore of Africa, the gilded sand, and evening vanish, and no more the low pale light across that land, nor now the long light on the sea, and here face downward in the sun, to feel how swift, how secretly, the shadow of the night comes on. MacLeish's poem gives me the shivers. It fills me with mysterious dread. When he writes, and through the twilight now the late few travelers in the westward pass, I feel myself to be one of those travelers. That is why I think Longfellow's poem, The Tide Rises, The Tide Falls, appeals to me so much. Who is Longfellow's traveler? How dark and mysterious are his coming and going. I think of a dream I had when I was a child. I was standing on the shore of a sea at twilight. My father and mother got into a rowboat, and slowly, silently, they disappeared into the darkening sea. I was left alone on the sand. Here is "The Tide Rises, The Tide Falls" by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. The tide rises, the tide falls, the twilight darkens, the curlew calls. Along the sea sands damp and brown, the traveler hastens toward the town. And the tide rises, the tide falls. Darkness settles on roofs and walls, but the sea in the darkness calls. The little waves with their soft white hands efface the footprints in the sands. And the tide rises, the tide falls. The morning breaks. The steeds in their stalls stamp and neigh as the hostler calls. The day returns, but nevermore returns the traveler to the shore. And the tide rises, the tide falls. I shall conclude this side of the cassette with Byron's little poem that was turned into a song, "So We'll Go No More A-Roving." So we'll go no more a-roving, so late into the night, though the heart be still as loving, and the moon be still as bright. For the sword outwears its sheath, and the soul wears out the breast, and the heart must force to breathe, and love itself hath rest. Though the night was made for loving, and the day returns too soon, yet we'll go no more.